Hi, I'm Jack. This is Master Chuladasa. Someone asked me to introduce him not very long ago, so I have absolutely no idea what I'm going to say, except for...
I don't either, so...
So we'll make it short and sweet. He's a brilliant man. He's a master meditator. And just from my own personal experience of working with the master, results happen. And the proof is in the pudding for me. I'd read a lot of books, studied a lot of people, and the first retreat that I did with John almost over 3 years ago now, I believe, was very profound for me and had an effect that has lasted. So... if anybody here is interested in studying meditation, for whatever reasons, I give him a big thumbs up.
Thank you, Jack.
That's it. Thank you.
Well, we're going to be talking about some serious dharma tonight and tomorrow. The title of this is Engaged Compassion. And, you know, it's interesting, the synchronicities, because I didn't suggest this topic. I fine-tuned the title, but I didn't suggest this topic. It actually came from Jesse and Stacy. But it was so appropriate, because on my own spiritual journey, I'm in a place, and in the last year have been exploring a place of a tremendous deepening of my own understanding of compassion and the development of compassion. And so it fits in really perfectly with my own journey. It's an aspect of the Dharma that I think that is, it's always acknowledged, but it tends to be glossed over. It doesn't tend to receive the degree of attention that it really deserves. And then very often the attention that it receives is, what's the right word? It's just saying all the same old things that have always been said without getting into it. And what I want to do is get into it more deeply with you, because I've been spending a lot of time getting into it more deeply and exploring it. Just about the time that, well, just to tell you, in my personal spiritual journey, I have many times had the experience of reaching a certain plateau. And the first few times this happened, I thought, okay, now, you know, I've got it all figured out and I understand what this is all about, and, you know. And then something would happen and it would just open me up to an entire new world. I could even say an entire new universe of understanding that I didn't even know was there before. And that would be the next stage of my personal growth. And quite a while ago, I stopped ever believing that there is an end to this, into this path. I do not think there is. And I'll go a step further and I would say it would be quite unfortunate if there was. In some traditions, the path of awakening is described a four-path model, a stream enterer and once returner and non-returner and arhat. And then there's other models of the bhumis. And of course, different schools. Some had 10 bhumis, some have 12 bhumis, some have, you know, 16 bhumis and things like that. But they always have this implication that you're going to get to someplace and then it's all over and there's nowhere else to go. And I don't think that's true. And I think it's a really good thing, because I think personally will always continue to grow, and as human spirituality in general develops, there will always be further to go. So for me, this exploration of compassion is a door opening to a whole new aspect of the Dharma. Not new, but one that I had no idea of what the depths and significance of it were before. And interestingly enough, once again, these synchronicities, these things that everything, I don't know if this happens in your life, but it seems like things just converge from different directions. There's a number of sociologists and people doing other kinds of social science who have in the last few years been focusing on the question of what is awakening. And the model for these studies is that they will set some criteria and they will try to identify a number of people who are awakened, who are acknowledged by others to be awakened, or who are acknowledged within a lineage to be awakened, or in some cases who proclaim themselves to be awakened, and extensively study and interview and compare their answers to these questions. And there's some wonderful information that is coming forth from this. And if you have the inclination, I'd invite you to study that. Two particularly well-known people that you have easy access to their information would be Jeffrey Martin and Richard Boyle. But I have received about four PhD dissertations which are based on doing exactly the same kind of study. So this is a whole area of exploration that's quite wonderful, and I'm glad that it's happening. And there's a lot of validity to it. I mean, I'll just one quick example, because I don't want to spend too much time talking about it. But Jeffrey Martin did this study. He started out with 500 potential candidates, narrowed it down to 50, interviewed them for tremendous periods of time, and then, of course, wrote up what he understood to be what they had said and gave them a chance to answer back. And then he took and he grouped their answers to the various questions in interviews and laid them out, and he found that they arrived in four different loci, and that these loci that they fell into corresponded with a very, very high degree of consistency to the four-path model that's described in the suttas that the Buddha himself laid out, the stream returner, once returner, non-returner, and arhat model. This is quite an amazing thing. But he and others have discovered a lot of other things. There's a lot of, what would you call it, traditional beliefs about what enlightenment is. And the various stages of enlightenment. And there's a lot of mythology associated with it. I mean, let's call it what it is. There's a lot of mythology. And their studies have revealed things that don't correspond to the orthodoxy, which is that sometimes people reach the highest stage and they decide they don't like it, and so they intentionally move back to a lesser stage of awakening because they're much more comfortable with it. You know, not something anybody ever teaches you, and not something that you would have expected. The other thing, I've found this as well, is that you sort of get the picture that, well, first of all, there's a one paradigm that is probably the least accurate, and probably the fewest of you would still be adherents of it, is the sudden awakening thing, that you go from being an ordinary worldling to be some fully, completely enlightened being. And I think we can pretty safely toss that out the window. And actually, we can go to the particular traditions that teach sudden enlightenment. And you find that they say things like, okay, now you're enlightened, but there's a whole lot more work to do. So anyway, the thing, though, that is most relevant to what we're talking about here that has come up in these different examinations of people who are awakened, or at least purported to be awakened, who manifest the various characteristics. And by the way, we're not just talking about Buddhism and the different schools of Buddhism. You know, they've gone beyond this into Christian mysticism, Sufism, Kabbalah, you know, shamans, many different things, to many different spiritual paths, and to find the most accomplished masters in those paths. And the one thing that's emerged that is totally relevant to what we're talking about here is that the wisdom component and the compassion component are closely linked, but they are not the same thing. They found people who had very high degrees of wisdom but didn't have that much compassion, and vice versa. They found people with a lot of compassion but not very much wisdom. And this fit exactly with the experience that I was having. And you know, I found myself launched into this involuntarily. You know, I didn't decide that I was going to explore the realm of compassion. It's something that rose up, and all I could do was ride the wave of it. But I've learned a lot about it as a result of that. Now, just to clarify, I mean, for certainly within the Buddhist paradigm, but if you're willing to overlook differences in terminology, different metaphysical systems that different religions and even different branches of Buddhism use, if you're willing to overlook that and understand the commonality of all of these things, everyone agrees that there is a transition stage that is very profound. That on the one side of that, you can very legitimately be referred to as a worldling. Your understandings may be highly refined. You may have accumulated a lot of glimpses into a deeper truth and a greater reality. These may play a great role in shaping you, but there's a threshold you haven't crossed. And there is a threshold that once you have crossed that, it's a very distinct threshold. It's sort of, to use an analogy, it's a slope. And until you cross that threshold, you can always slip back. But once you've crossed that threshold, you're now a different kind of being. And in the language of the Buddha, you're now an Aryan. You're one of the noble ones. He said, no one's born a Brahmin, you become a Brahmin. And this is the idea, that there is this threshold that you cross. And if you're willing to try to see the commonalities and to overlook the differences in the ways this is discussed and presented and the words that are used, you find that pretty well every spiritual tradition agrees to the same certain characteristics of this transition. And it is the profound realization that you are not a separate self, and that absolutely everything is interconnected. And in fact, in the four-path model, that's an important part of the definition of what it means to be a stream entrant. Some of you, I know this is a Mahayana center, and I've known many of you for many years, and so you would refer to this as this transition as the path of seeing. And if you look at what it means to achieve the path of seeing, what it is that you attain the deep, profound realization of the emptiness of self. So when we speak of emptiness, we're speaking of another really profound insight, which is really the realization that absolutely nothing that arises in your consciousness has a self nature of being what it appears to be. That we each live in our own private world. There's enough commonalities that we believe in a consensual reality. But the way we perceive things has more to do with our own minds and with our own conditioning than it does with that greater reality that we are a part of. And that's why we experience it differently. With simple things, you know, like this cup. There's not a huge difference in the way we perceive something like this cup, but there's still differences. One of you may love you that and say, you know, that's one of the most beautifully shaped, that's the ideal cup, you know. Everything else is a crude imitation, and that's what it's really trying to approach. And somebody else may say, you know, that's the plainest, ugliest cup. I've seen so many more beautiful cups. But we perceive everything differently. And of course, the more complex the nature is of something, the more differently we see it. And even the very cupness of this. I mean, is this a cup to a hummingbird? Is it even a cup to a cat? You know, as a matter of fact, would it be a cup to, if we took it to a Tarahumara tribesman and handed it to him? You know, I'm going to use an example I used a few days ago because it worked really well. You know, is remember the movie, The Gods Must Be Crazy, and the Coke bottle falls out. You know, and it's, nobody ever seen anything like this. What was it? And it became something in their minds. It became a sacred object, but then created a lot of disagreement. And then this poor guy got assigned the task of returning it to the child, to the gods, and saying, thanks, but no thanks, it's causing too much trouble. But, you know, it's certainly, to any of us, it was a Coke bottle, but to those people who'd never seen it before, it was something totally different. So this is what emptiness is about. Emptiness means that, an aspect of emptiness that overlaps with impermanence is that there are no things. There absolutely are no things. Impermanence tells us there is only process. There's only process. And when we're taking the first baby steps towards understanding impermanence, we think, things come into existence and then they immediately go out of existence. And everything's constantly changing. But we kind of imagine that there is at least a moment of existence before the arising and passing away. And then as our understanding deepens, we realize there's only process. There are no things at all. Not for the tiniest microsecond you can imagine. You know, not for the Planck moment of time does something exist in a state of thinkness. And so where does all this thingness come from? It's a projection of our mind. And so all things are empty. Not only do they not have a self nature of being what we think they are, you know, a set of characteristics and attributes that we attach to them, but their very thingness is an illusion. And this, so you can realize the emptiness of everything in the world and still cling to the belief that there's a self, that there's something here, that there's this stream of consciousness, or what is it? That's what we always come down to, you know, is, well, you can take everything else away from me, but I mean, I'm conscious, and there's a stream of consciousness, right? You can't take that away from me. But no, then you realize that that's just as empty as everything else. So this transition that separates worldlings from the awakened is the realization that there is no separate self, that that's as empty as everything else. And that's what the realization, that's what the path of seeing is you may prior to that have had insight into the emptiness of everything else. But when you achieve Darsana Marga, then what you've had is the realization of the emptiness of self. Or to put it more accurately, is for a moment you've become truly empty to yourself. And you can't forget that. So this is a threshold that we cross. And the nature of this, the realization that we are not separate selves in a world of other, and that absolutely everything is interconnected, this is the first stage of awakening. This is the critical threshold in every path and in every spiritual tradition, although it may be put in different terms. In Christian and Jewish terms, of course, in Islamic terms, it's put in terms of realizing that there is that you are not separate from the divine, that you have arisen from, and that you are never truly separate from the divine. And then the rest of the spiritual path is coming to the place of full-time realization of that, you know, trying to figure out what that means. Because you know you're not God. That's pretty obvious. There's no mistaking of that. Yeah. So now this realization that has, in whatever form it takes, this essential component of the separate self that I feel that I am, and that when I lose my mindfulness, that I might temporarily think that I am before I catch on to it. That with the passage of that, there is a true compassion that arises. And so there's nobody who you could legitimately attach the label of awakened to who does not have a kind of true compassion that's quite different than what worldlings have. But the thing that I realized, and the thing that has become apparent in these studies that I described to you, is that that's only the beginning. That's only the beginning. And compassion is something that needs further cultivation and development. And there are some traditions, and I would give a lot of credit to the Tibetan tradition in particular, for recognizing that, and worldlings in training are given numerous opportunities and numerous practices to do to help develop as they're moving towards the wisdom aspect. They have a lot of tools to help move them towards the compassion aspect as well. And in the Theravada, it's the loving kindness meditations that we do. And So that's there. But let me explain a little bit. Let me back up a little bit, and let's frame this whole discussion in terms of human nature. Human beings have two natures, and these exist side by side, and they interact with each other. And in different people, one aspect of human nature will get emphasized much more strongly than others. But these two natures are what make us what we are. They're part of what make us so unique if we look around and compare ourselves to all the other beings on this planet. One of those natures is selfishness. We're born with this inborn tendency as our brain begins to mature and as our mind begins to develop, to see ourselves as separate entities. And the and there is this, even prior to that becoming a conscious cognitive belief in selfhood, there is a sense of selfness and separateness that is much more subtle and much more deeply ingrained in us. So we start out with that. And as soon as we're old enough to communicate with other people, that gets further developed. However it is that our particular culture deals with the selfish aspect of human nature, we assimilate that development and we manifest it. And there are big differences in cultures. You know, Asian cultures are quite different than Western cultures in the way they view the relationship of the self to the larger community of beings in the world. And there are quite a few, in fact, native cultures, what we would regard as more primitive, that tend to minimize that, intentionally minimize that. I lived in Canada for quite a while and had exposure to the Northwest coastal Indian tribes, and you've heard of the potlatch. And what happens in the potlatch is anybody who's been successful in accumulating a lot of stuff holds a big party and gives it all away. Right? And this is an extremely important part of their culture. And for anybody to get too involved with accumulation in a selfish way, their society, their culture, brings a pressure to bear on them to instead to act in a selfless way and give away everything, you know. So there's different ways that this is dealt with, but certainly in the West, the idea of individuality and therefore the selfish component of our instinctive, intuitive behaviors is particularly strongly culturally developed. And I suppose capitalism is perhaps the most overt manifestation of that on a large scale that you could point to. But it's there in all of us all of the time. But the other side of our nature is we're born with a tendency towards altruism as well. We're born with a tendency for selflessness. And these two exist in us side by side. And the reason that we evolved to have these two tendencies side by side is the explanation for how we've come to be what we are and how we've achieved the level of what from the point of view of biology would be regarded as reproductive success. You know, we've been extremely successful in filling just about every habitable environment, the adaptations to the most hostile environments and the growth of human populations and cultures in all of these different environments. This success has come about not because of our selfish nature and not because of our selfless nature, but because we have both of these. But few people truly recognize or fully appreciate the altruistic side of human nature. And it's an odd thing, because it probably has more to do with the quality of our lives than selfishness ever could. You know, look at animals in the wild, and very few of them exhibit the degree of cooperativity that human beings do. You could not even begin to approach the lifestyle that you live on your own. I mean, think about it. Everything, absolutely everything that we take for granted, and look at these huge cities, transportation systems, and the technologies, and everything that we enjoy. This is the result of cooperativity. It has been driven by competition, and selfishness has played a role in the development of these things as well. But we do have these two sides to our human nature. And compassion is all about the altruistic side of human nature. And it's all about developing that. It's all about coming to recognize and acknowledge its existence and to work with it in a way that we actually develop it, that we grow more compassionate. And this, to the degree that we intentionally cultivate compassion, can be very conducive to our attainment of wisdom. And the attainment of wisdom in itself, because it breaks down the root supposition behind selfishness. I mean, selfishness is empty. Selfishness is completely empty. It's a mind-generated illusion that we dwell in. But our minds are designed to create that delusion, and it serves a purpose and it works. But nevertheless, it's a delusion. When we see past that delusion, then it opens us up to the more altruistic side of our nature. And that's why compassion always rises together with awakening. But it doesn't automatically mean that that side of our nature, which is constantly manifesting but never recognized and acknowledged, is fully developed. It needs to be much more fully developed than that. So now this was billed as an interactive teaching. So now we're going to get into the interactive part. So we could never become compassionate, truly compassionate, if it wasn't already a part of our nature. And it is. So I want us to explore that. And I'd like us to talk about what it is that we think compassion is. And then I'd like us to compare the idea of compassion to a couple of other closely related ideas, sympathy and empathy. Okay? So now I'm going to ask you. We go around, you've been talking for years, we've been reading books, you've been hearing people come and teach, and everybody's saying compassion, blah, blah, blah. Does everybody mean the same thing by compassion? Do we know what we mean by compassion? So that's what I want to talk about. What is this word referring to? What on earth is compassion?
For me, compassion seems to be related to a sense of connectivity with somebody else. Mm-hmm. Where your sense of self is in what I think people would call empathy of the human condition. So mm-hmm. My sadness, your sadness, is felt here as something universal.
Yeah.
And in that, I can have a closer understanding to you or to anyone, or if that's love. Mm-hmm. The whole range of emotions and experiences. So in that moment of true compassion, I actually, my sense of self gets larger.
Yeah, it's expanded to include.
It's expanded to include. So yeah, that's right. That's my feeling and thoughts on compassion.
Yeah. And I would agree with that. And I would say what you've said, it overlaps with empathy. You know, so there's a strong overlap there. Let's hear some other views here.
To me, compassion is a deep level of understanding and caring about each other's feelings. When people go through things themselves, they feel for others. So a deep, deep level of understanding, empathy, feeling, caring, mm-hmm. interconnectivity, and looking out for the well-being of others.
Yes, I would agree with that. Let me see if I can... Okay, I'm going to do a little steering of this. And first of all, compassion is a compound of two words. Compassion. And it means with passion. Okay? So when you're thinking about what compassion means, let's think a little bit about what the word passion means. For that matter, okay, that when you tell me what you think compassion is, I want you to first tell me what you think the word passion refers to. And here, just, I'll help you out a little bit. Okay. Comes from the old Latin root, pati, the same root that gives rise to pathos and pathology. And in fact, we refer to the passion of Christ, right? And the suffering of Christ. And pati means suffering. So if we were to go to the root and say, compassion means shared suffering.
Shared suffering.
Shared suffering, okay? But right away we know that there's something wrong with that, okay? And we think, because we know that's not compassion. Let's go back to the word passion again. So okay, it's rooted in a Latin word that means suffering, but it has another meaning that you're all very, very familiar with. To have passion for something, right? Love, it means there's an energy associated with that. And it's not all pain and suffering either, right?
Enthusiasm.
Yeah, it's enthusiasm. It's action, it's energy, right? You have a passion for something, you know. Joseph Campbell said, find your passion. Right?
Find your bliss.
And to be passionate about something, to be a passionate Buddhist, to be a passionate meditator, to be a passionate anything, right? So it has this other meaning as well that I think is very important. So anyway, I'm giving you a little steering here. So come on, somebody else tell me what they think compassion is, keeping those ideas in mind. There's a hand up way in the back.
I felt like a lot of us in this room
Allison, can you just give a chance for the microphone to get there? You do have a voice that projects well, but this will be better. By the way, I'm so glad to see you again. I haven't seen you in years.
Hi, everyone. I think a lot of us in this room have sort of learned a textbook's definition of compassion, mm-hmm. where it's the wish that others don't suffer, the wish that we could take away others' suffering. So when you're saying this desire and this enthusiasm, I'm thinking about bodhicitta, and I'm thinking mm-hmm. about this bigger compassion where it's, it's not about being nice. It's mm-hmm. about really wanting deep down inside that others don't have to suffer and a desire to somehow okay. take away that suffering.
Yeah, I know that I'm going to push you to go a little deeper in this.
Yeah.
So, I'll bet you're not saying, oh, gee, I wish that person wasn't suffering. No. Is that what you're saying?
No.
Okay, what are you really saying?
It's deep and mm-hmm. it's sublime.
Mm-hmm. So I sublimely wish you were.
No.
Doesn't have a component of, I've got to do something.
Well, yeah, there's an urgency. Yeah, that's what I was saying. Yeah, the desire, yeah, the bodhicitta, yeah, the desire that I want to do whatever it takes to
right.
get myself out of suffering.
And there you've
so
gone.
That I can
and
help
you've
others.
Used that word desire that we always thought was desires is yeah, bad right. stuff, right? But it's not in this case, is it?
Right.
When this
desire.
Drive comes up, when this desire comes up, you know, if I can relieve your compassion, if I can do something, let me do something about it.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
So I think compassion involves finding oneness, because mm-hmm. without finding oneness, you can't really communicate to the other and hear what the other's really saying, or feel what the other's saying, or have the exchange of energy.
Or know what they really need, how to help them, right? If you don't go into their situation enough, you might do something that you think is gonna help, but it either doesn't, or might even make them feel worse, right? So yeah, we have to get to really be compassionate. We have to get out of ourselves and out of our idea of how to help and what's right and what's wrong, the way to help.
And that's also where the Christian, where you know you allow God, let go, yeah. you know, where you let the ego or what you think is going on mm-hmm. get out of the way, or Buddhism, let the Buddha come or whatever,
yeah,
but it
yeah.
really is allowing for what you don't know, so there can be that place of the heart.
That's right.
Of the heart.
You let the heart open, and stuff, once you open the doors, it goes two ways. It goes out and it goes in,
yeah.
right? Yeah.
Well, that... You spoke to what I was initially going to say. A wonderful teacher taught me that when you break down compassion, passion, suffering. And from my own suffering, I feel so much understanding has been built within my heart, and it instigates deep empathy for mm-hmm. many, all beings, for all the suffering, you know, the pain.
Yes.
It's not my pain, it's the pain, like the suffering. And oftentimes, maybe it isn't... Maybe we don't have the ability to remove the suffering,
mm-hmm.
but by having someone sit with you in the pain, you don't resist the pain as much,
mm-hmm.
and the suffering is lessened deeply. And we, again, the oneness, all these answers come mm-hmm. together. You know, you find yeah. oneness and understanding and empathy, and then together we can mm-hmm. create action.
Yes, and I'll offer an example of that. Maybe as we go around, we could start reinforcing our descriptions with examples. But suppose somebody is suffering in a way, and there's nothing within our power to actually take that suffering away. It's maybe somebody in the terminal stages of a disease, and and the suffering they're experiencing may be emotional and psychological as well as physical. You know, the morphine drip can help the physical and take some of the edge off the psychological, but it's still there. But there's this thing that we can do. If compassion means doing something more than doing something, yet you can't do anything, if you sit there and empathize with them, if you... And that's what empathy means. really. Empathy means that you're feeling what they're feeling, and you share it with them, and it allows them it allows them to bear their suffering more easily. So how about that? We've just discovered that not only are empathy and compassion connected to each other, but empathy can be a way of manifesting compassion. It's one of the things that we can empathize, and empathizing is one of the things that we can do as an act of compassion. Yeah. So, it means to suffer with. Yes.
I think, you know, I'm kind of passionate about this topic, and it's changed its meaning over time for me. And for me, passion, the word passion alone, it cuts through the layers that keep us separate, all those sort of contrived ideas of who we are. When we're passionate about something, it opens us in a different way. And sometimes that can be a hurtful way. Mm-hmm. But in compassion...
But Trump has a lot of passion.
Yes, yes. Yes, but in compassion, when things break down, it's to me, at this stage, and it's always changing, it's a deep awareness and acknowledgement of our own suffering that allows us, instead of closing us off from others, it opens us to others. And in a way gives us purpose for suffering. I'm not saying people should suffer, be careful, but gives us a purpose to use what we've experienced in a way that's helpful for others. To me, sympathy holds people at arm's length. Mm-hmm. Sympathy is not something I'm interested in at all. Empathy, I love it, but empathy alone can get us lost in someone else's suffering, and then we're not there.
Yeah, it's bad enough that you're suffering, now I'm suffering too. We're not ahead.
Yeah. And keeps us from being able to hear. And I think I've actually come to a place where I think one of the most powerful things we can do for each other is to witness. Mm-hmm. What do we do when we can't do? It's not that we shouldn't try to do things and volunteer for things and help. But there are situations, and it's not just terminal illness, there are situations where the best thing we could do is be a witness. Mm-hmm. And to do that, we have to have allowed ourselves to be aware of what suffering has been to us. Because otherwise you get triggered, and you can't witness somebody else's pain if you haven't been open to your own.
Right.
So to me, compassion is an opening to your own pain, which can be separate from awakening, because awakening is about removing suffering from pain, But having experienced it, and then use that experience, have the strength to be able to witness someone else's pain from wherever they are.
Yeah. Well, let's just complicate the situation here, just for the
okay? I never do that.
All right. So, if you empathize too strongly with someone else's suffering, now both of you are suffering, and there are situations, and I don't know your name.
Courtney.
You look familiar. Have we met before? No. Just okay. But but empathy can be a way of helping others, but empathy gets out of control, and you know it's no longer helpful. As a matter of fact, and I've experienced this, and I've seen other people experience this. You know, they're sick in their hospital, they're in the pain, or they're you know, whatever it is, and everybody comes in, and they're feeling so much, and they say, you know, this is terrible. I feel so much worse because these people come in and it makes these other people feel bad. I'd rather they stayed away and went and did something happy, you know? I mean, I can deal with my own suffering. I don't need to be the cause of other people's suffering. So empathy can be a problem. Empathy can cloud your mind. Empathy can blind you to more productive things that you can do. And let's not throw sympathy out the window. And you're correct about sympathy. Now, if you wanted to go to the dictionary and look up what sympathy is, essentially sympathy is where you're not feeling the other's pain, but you are saying, gee, you know, it's really unfortunate that this, you're recognizing it is really unfortunate that this person has that. And sympathy, yeah, it does have that arm's length quality to it.
Feeling sorry for someone with sympathy.
Yeah, you can feel sorry for someone. And, of course, feeling sorry for someone can lead to compassion. There's nothing about sympathy that precludes compassion. And what do we say about people that have achieved the highest levels of awakening? What do we say about their suffering? Do they suffer? No, I mean, that's the whole point. The Buddha promised a path to the end of suffering. And so then how could you say somebody who's highly awakened is compassionate if it requires that they feel the suffering of the other person? You can't, right? But an awakened being understands the suffering. They know what it's like for the person to suffer. And so they're still capable of a high level of compassion. You don't have to empathize in order to be compassionate. And as a matter of fact, you do have to keep your empathy, you have to moderate your empathy for your compassion to truly be valuable and effective. That got some hands up. Okay.
Well, you just brought up, I did look up that word compassion not too long ago. Mm-hmm. There it is. Okay. But you just mentioned levels of compassion, which I think is really important. But the definition I found was to recognize the suffering in another. You know, make sure they're really suffering, because maybe they're having a good time. I don't know. But and the wish to alleviate that suffering. So
yes,
that's kind of obvious, I guess. But I always really did not like that Bob Dylan song, "I Pity the Poor Immigrant." And that word pity is sticks in my mind. And a nice definition I saw of distinguishing between compassion and pity is when you come at somebody with fear, mm-hmm. like you poor sucker kind of thing. At least that's my
opinion. Superiority.
Or yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's and I've experienced that in many places. Like wow, you know, that looks like suffering, and I'm glad I'm not there. But anyway, but compassion is when you approach somebody with love and understanding,
yes.
You know, and even if you don't understand it, at least. So, I mean, for me, it is really site specific, and levels. And I remember reading Pema Chodron, and she talked about how she was helping one of her students, and she was like rocking, like she really got this gal to like get all rocked up, and I'm going to meditate and be a good Buddha, and then she gets the next person, and she kind of tries to use the same shtick on her. And it goes completely flat. And she just kind of had this realization that you cannot, there's no pat answer for everybody. And so it really takes, I guess, a lot of wisdom, or certainly a lot of awareness around what we're dealing with if we're actually trying to help somebody. And you've already pointed out how mm-hmm. we think we might be helping, and actually we might be hindering. It's like, mm-hmm. get the hell away from me kind of thing. And I try not to... when I try to practice this, I try to be grounded, and if I don't think I've got the goods to give them, I just mm-hmm. don't. I mean, a lot of times it can just be listening, and that's huge, or holding a hand, which has all kinds of physiological things. But it's a great subject. Yeah. It's good stuff.
Well, can I kind of sum up where one of the places that we've got to? We've touched on a lot of different things, but what makes it compassion is that there is the desire, the wish, the compulsion to do something. Whether or not it's possible to do anything, there, it's only compassion when it comes with this, it has this drive, yes, this compulsion, this, you know, this motivation. It moves us. And that makes it different than empathy and sympathy. And sympathy and empathy are really important and closely related. But what separates passion from everything, compassion from everything else, is the passion component. It is the move to action. And of course you have to deal with your compassion if you can't do anything. If there's absolutely nothing at all you can do, then you're gonna have to deal with this compulsion, this drive, this will to act, this need to make a difference. And that's where the wisdom comes in.
Yes, excellent conversation. I'm really enjoying this. My personal experience, and this is going to end up with a question. Mm-hmm. My personal experience with this subject is that that the path to compassion, the few times I've actually been compassionate in my life, came because I had suffered what the person was suffering. Mm-hmm. That triggered empathy and the lowering of the barrier of self and other. So yeah. I know exactly how they feel. But that's empathy. Mm-hmm. And when it's an individual, I don't feel what I often feel when I look at the suffering of the world, which is, I can't do anything about that. I've got to step away from this. It's almost like I've become, cold toward it. I turn the page because it's so painful and there's no action that can occur and I'm feeling the compulsion to action. So I get all that. The action can occur, especially when it's on human scale. It's another person in my life. It's presented to me. I can do something about that. But what I've experienced also is that so much of the suffering that I've experienced and that I'm seeing in someone else that I'm empathizing with is self-inflicted. And if I stay centered in the empathy, I become enabling for them to continue that. I have to be wise. So for me, the component of detached wisdom, the empathy triggers the call to action, but the action should be, in my mind, in my own experience, I'm not skillful about what I do unless it's tempered with wisdom. Yeah. That's my experience with this.
That's very good. I'm so glad you said that, because compassion, we have to develop the compassion muscle, but we have to develop compassion as a skill too. And compassionate can lead to very unskillful behavior, like anything else. Everything can, you know. And we make mistakes and we have to learn from them. But we don't run away from compassion because we make a mistake, right? We learn from it and we learn to be more effectively compassionate. Yes.
I think that you just said that compassion doesn't necessitate empathy. But how, so I have, I'm having a hard time with that. How do you have this drive to do, to act, unless you really feel what, let's say, someone else is feeling? So did you say that a minute ago?
I said that it is not necessary for an act of compassion. But it is necessary that you know the nature of the suffering. You don't need to enter into the empathic state where you're feeling the suffering, but you have to have a personal knowledge, and it doesn't need to be of exactly that kind of suffering, but you have to have a personal knowledge of suffering first before you can have compassion. Which brings up a really interesting kind of thing, going once again to talking about people that are highly awakened. They came from a place of suffering, but they transcended the suffering. Not only did they transcend the suffering, but in the process of the way they transcended the suffering was by realizing that all suffering is ultimately self-inflicted. That the cause of all suffering is craving, desire and aversion. And that all desire and aversion is rooted in attachment to self, in delusion, you know? So there's a really interesting thing. So, but you don't need to experience the suffering at the time that you're manifesting the compassion. But you do have to have knowledge of suffering.
I just thought that for me, compassion is when you're pushing your own boundaries. You want to do something, and it's really hard for you to, you know, want to do it, but you're going overboard, you're going something beyond your capabilities even, when you have compassion, and you're doing, that's the action.
Well, Elizabeth, I agree with you.
Sympathy and empathy are mostly feelings. You know,
that's like it's a really important thing that we push our boundaries. But when we're talking about compassion, every act of compassion doesn't require that you push your boundaries. It requires that you put that you engage full-heartedly in the particular situation. But you may not need to push your own boundaries in that particular situation.
Yeah, sometimes, but sometimes you're going above and beyond. I mean,
to grow internally, you have to grow. You have to push your boundaries to grow. It's the only way that you can grow. It's the only way that we do grow. But I'm just pointing out the difference, and I agree with you totally. And that's the title of this is Engaged Compassion. We're focusing on the compassion part, but to be engaged involves pushing the boundaries, and so we're going to get to that. But just speaking of compassion itself, we can be compassionate without necessarily pushing our own boundaries.
Yeah, just to add to the discussion, compassion for me seems to be adding an element of acceptance of things as the way they are now, to maybe allow someone to come out of victim consciousness or whatever. And it's sort of like the wise application of empathy and just the willingness to help.
Yes.
But that movement towards acceptance and having that strength to say really things are okay and allow that person to process whatever it is. And just, you know, even in the world, like, it's dreadful some of the things that happen out there, but having compassion just even for the world itself and allowing that acceptance within yourself is, I think, beneficial as well.
Well, I agree with you totally. If we go beyond just talking about what compassion is to how do we maximize our compassion, and how do we make our compassion maximally effective? Compassion requires to be combined with wisdom and with equanimity. And wisdom and equanimity and share the same aspect of radical acceptance. Until the more completely and the more totally that you can surrender to what is, the more empowered you are to fulfill that urge that compassion gives rise to. Right? To the degree that you're in resistance to what is, you've lost some of your power and you've lost your clarity and so forth. So to maximize your compassion, you've got to have that equanimity and you've got to have that total acceptance. You've got to let go of the resistance. And now you can bring all of the full power of your being into whatever it is that you can do as an act of compassion, make it maximize its effectiveness. But that's something we have to learn. And yes. Yes, you do.
That's absolutely, what you just pinned was absolutely beautiful. because on the surface, mm-hmm. on the surface, you would think that you could be led to a situation, if you have equanimity, you could have led to a situation that I can't do anything. What good is me doing anything? Mm-hmm. So, which would typically generate non-doing, you yeah. know, backing off.
Yeah.
But what you pinned was total engagement.
Total engagement.
And empowering. Mm-hmm. And that's an aspect that I get glimpses of every now and then, and the only thing I can say is, wow. You know, it's just absolutely gorgeous. And that's the aspect that makes me an optimist. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yes, great.
And it's all worth it.
Yeah.
You know, no matter what it is, this mm-hmm. this trip here is all worth it. And you just affirmed that, and that's so beautiful. Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for getting it.
Yeah.
I struggled so much with that drive for compassion that I mm-hmm. wrote a little memo on my arm. Equanimity. I wrote it like 4 years ago. I had just got it tattooed on my arm.
Mm-hmm.
It was so funny. I didn't even really explore the concept too deeply before getting it written. But, you know, it you have to take care of this heart and before yeah. or in the same amount of time or while you're taking care of other people, while you're empathizing with the world and having compassion for the self and keeping the body healthy mm-hmm. and, you know, the balance and the wisdom.
Yes. And far too often people look and they're overwhelmed and it's too much. I can't do anything and they give up. And the result is apathy, apathy, you know. Not empathy, but apathy. Right? Not sympathy, but apathy. And this is the way that we withdraw. And this is untrained and and misunderstood compassion. Compassion produces a drive to do something, and then you see, well, it's hopeless, there's nothing I can do. So you cram it all down and you bury it and you cauterize it, you know, you cut it off, you know, and you just focus in and in here and you just give up hope on anything else. That's just, you know, you can't do that. To have the heart wide open, you have to have equanimity, right? Because otherwise you open the heart up, you see how big the problem is, you enter into hopelessness and despair, and the heart closes again. Yeah. And that happens way too much, way too much.
So one thing, expression I heard from Sharon Salzberg that really stuck with me is compassion as the quivering of the heart in response to suffering. That was one thing that it really resonates with what you're saying,
yeah.
Not like not getting immersed in it, and it doesn't rule out a little equanimous distance. But the other thing that's striking me is about the word suffering. You know, it's such a heavy word in English, and there's suffering that's really much closer to home. You know, there's the person that cut you off in traffic, and mm-hmm. you're suffering, and, you know, people don't behave that way unless they're suffering in some...
That's exactly right.
And,
yeah.
And you know, and as I say, suffering, it's a strong word, but unless they're somehow not at ease, and you're not at ease in your life. And so I think there's many, mm-hmm. many opportunities for... just in ordinary encounters for, you know, kind of seeing that unsatisfactoriness
mm-hmm.
and kind of allowing yourself to resonate with it or quiver with it, but have the reaction of compassion rather than irritation.
Yes. You know, we've learned a bit in the last while about how the human mind and the human brain works. And everybody heard of mirror neurons? I imagine. So this is one of these things that has really captured the popular imagination, and rightly so. To discover that anytime you observe anyone else doing something, anytime you really observe, that the same neural circuits that would be involved in your doing that thing are activated. And these are called mirror neurons. And it was first discovered in terms of physical activities. And I think one of its earliest applications is high-performance athletes watch videotapes of their very best performance. And that has as much effect as them repeating then practicing the particular thing that athlete does. As a matter of fact, the more times they watch, not just themselves, but anybody else, say it's a skier performing that absolutely perfect jump, the same neurons that control the muscles at the most minute degree, they're responding to what you see and learning from that. And the same thing's true of emotions. The mirror neurons, the body language that we talk about, that's mirror neurons. When you see somebody that's happy, then the same neurons are activated in your mind. When you see somebody that's suffering, the same neurons are activated in your mind. And so this is at the root of empathy. And of course, nature has to limit this, because otherwise, you know, we're going around experiencing what everybody else is experiencing. It's true that we're all connected, but we're not all one, and we all have our unique roles to play, you know. And so, but this is the source of it, just to see yourself in someone else, and to see someone else in yourself, to experience that in yourself. And this is what opens us up, and this is what we need to practice to develop those compassion muscles. But, you know, so that we recognize. But there's so much more to it than that. Because otherwise we're just developing empathy. Where does the compassion come from? It comes from one sense in which it comes from is when we expand the boundary of ourself to include another. But the ultimate of that is when you drop all boundaries and you see that you are connected to everyone and that you are not a separate self at all. And then this brings you into a completely different kind of relationship with everyone that you see. And you still have the mirror neurons, you know. But you don't have to, you can learn to relate the suffering of others to your own suffering. And you can acquire a deep power of empathy, but it's a kind of empathy that need not drag you into the same degree of suffering that it is that you're feeling this urge to do something about. But it's the trigger for the urge. You know, it's because you're having an inward experience of that experience that pain. If I was experiencing that pain, I would want that pain to stop, right? And so now you are going to take an action to ease the pain of someone else as if it were your own pain. And this is how we develop, is that as if becomes the really important part. we can come into a place of shared being without the shared misery. And it's very important that we learn to do that. Right? And we start talking about how you develop the compassion muscle, and we make use of both empathy and sympathy to do that. And we need to. Because if we too much empathy, and it's not going to work. And we go too far on the sympathy side, we're just a little bit too aloof and become in danger of becoming apathetic. So we've got to go through a process of learning how to be effectively compassionate. Who has the mic? Oh, there's the mic, Matt.
Yeah, I just had a recent experience, the contrary to that, the blockage of compassion. And I realized I had a friend who I have compassion for. She's had a number of issues. But internally, I was still holding a harsh or false judgment. Mm-hmm. And I realized that, because I was treating her very nicely, et cetera, but I was looking down on her at certain levels for certain things that she was doing, like cheating on her taxes or whatever it is. And I realized that that false judgment or that harsh mm-hmm. judgment was a severe block to it. And as soon as I saw the inability to be completely compassionate, and it was that harsh judgment that was sort of blocking mm-hmm. it, well, the sort of floodgates opened and it changed mm-hmm. the whole relationship that I have with her, at least on my side. And in terms of the even the treatment coming back to me mm-hmm. is different, because I think the harsh judgment sort of created unconscious guilt that I was unaware of, and it certainly blocked, as I say, the compassion. So for me now it seems, and this is a bit like a synchronicity, mm-hmm. to lose really all those sort of false judgments and harsh judgments that are probably unconscious. Yeah. And that the losing of those things will make it, there's yes. automatic compassion after that.
Right. Compassion does require discerning and discernment, but not judgment. And unfortunately, we're highly prone to judgment. So it's something that we have to overcome. Take the example, I'm sure you have it here, the way we do where I live, is that every time you're at a stoplight, there's somebody that's standing there with a sign, and they're wanting you to give you some money. And you look at that person and you can tell. They say, need food, okay? And you look at them and you say, that's an alcoholic. If I give them some money, they're gonna go buy some cheap wine or some Listerine to drink or some beer or, they're gonna go find some alcohol, so depending on how much money you give them. And how do you react to that? It's really easy to bring judgment into it, isn't it? And say, well, it's your own fault. You should stop drinking. Are you being compassionate? Are you being wise? There could be wisdom in it, but you're certainly not doing anybody any good. You may not be doing anybody any harm. Now, if seeing that person and knowing their situation led you to do something to make a larger change, then that would be a manifestation of compassion. But it's so easy for us to judge. Have you ever had a friend and you did something that would help them and they made a really poor decision and they ended up in a worse situation than they were before? And so because you helped them the first time, they come back to you and they say, I need help again. How easy is it to make the judgment to say, it's a waste for me to try to help you again, because you don't pay attention to the good advice. I told you what to do. I gave you the money to solve whatever the problem was, and you went and did something else, and you know, judgment comes into this so very, very easy. And we've got to watch out for that. I would suggest to you, you know, just using these kinds of examples, that when that happens to you, you bring a whole lot of mindfulness to the situation. And I mean, you're looking at yourself, and you're looking at your own reactions. And you say, where is my reaction coming from? And is my reaction consistent with what the values that I hold, and the kind of person that I want to be, and the spiritual path that I'm on? Is my action consistent with that? Is my action consistent with the outcome that I would like to see from this particular situation? Now you're in a much better position to make a decision about whether to do or whether not to do, or more importantly, whether to do something different, right? But if you haven't done it, give a dollar to somebody that you know is going to go and buy a drink, okay? And remind yourself, however, I mean, here's the radical acceptance. This is the situation that exists. If he doesn't get a drink, in the next few hours, he's going to start experiencing DTs. You know, I don't know if you know, but that withdrawal from alcohol is even worse than from heroin and other drugs. It's a terrible, terrible thing. So if you think of it in those terms, that yes, he's going to go and buy a drink, and it's going to spare him for a few hours the effects of DTs, you know, and delirium tremens. And then see where your compassion is and see where your judgment is. And so I'm not suggesting that we should all go out and support alcoholics and spare them the DTs. Although I can tell you a story about a program that somebody's doing that this comes into the category of doing something else. You either do something or do nothing. But I'm saying, see if you can overcome your own judgment, and see if you can deliberately help somebody who you know is responsible for their own suffering, but nevertheless, they're in a situation where their suffering is real, and there is something that you can do to ease it and see how you feel about it afterwards. I'll tell you how you're going to feel about it. You're going to feel good about it, and you're going to be surprised that you feel good about it.
Hi. There's a stance that's used in anthropology sometimes. It's called the participant observer. Mm-hmm. And I think that if we participate too much, we become either bleeding hearts or part of the problem. And if we're too much of an observer, a cold fish.
Yes,
so I wrote a little poem about this. Neither bleeding heart nor cold fish, combining both a pious wish. So you have both impulses within you of the bleeding heart and the cold fish, but you have an imaginary line that you tow. Mm-hmm. And towing that line between the participation and observation is very difficult, because most people will either try to pull you to become more of a participator or push you in the other way, in that's the right. other direction as the cold fish. Thank you.
We can talk about all the many forms that compassion can take too, but here's one. Is that I've been listening to these teachers and studying the Dharma, and I know that everybody's suffering comes from inside. Nobody's suffering comes from outside. And that anything that I do externally to try to relieve the suffering of someone else It's just, you know, it just keeps the wheel of samsara turning, right? They're going to have a little bit of joy and happiness, and then they're going to have some pain and suffering, and everybody's playing in the big casino, somehow believing that somehow we're going to come out with more joy and happiness than pain and suffering, even though we know the odds are stacked against us, you know. Even though not only are they stacked against us, but with every year that passes, the odds get stacked even more against us. You know? But we keep playing the game, right? And so you look at this and you say, okay, this whole samsara thing, you know, you're not going to trick me. You're not going to suck me into that. Because I learned and my teachers told me that everybody's suffering comes from inside. So I'm going to sit here and be enlightened, and then I'll go out and teach them to be enlightened, and then they won't suffer anymore. That's a pretty wonderful idea. It's a really good thing to do. I'm totally in favor of it. I endorse it 100%. But it sure is a good excuse for doing nothing. And it does absolutely nothing at all to develop your compassion muscle. You know, you can say over and over again, however many times you want, you know, I'm practicing to become enlightened so that I can bring all sentient beings to awakening. Yeah. Is that really why you're doing what you're doing? Is that really why you're not doing the things that you could do? No. So we got to look at all the different ways, all the different forms that our compassion can take. All the way from what would be obviously futile to take all the money out of your bank account and your 401k and everything else, get it converted into bags of $1 bills, and then drive all over every metropolitan area you could, handing out $1 bills to people standing on the corner. That's one extreme. And the other extreme is you say, I'm not going to get sucked into this world of samsara. I know how it works. I'm going to sit here and I'm going to get enlightened. And then when I'm a Buddha, I'm going to go and wake everybody up and then they won't suffer anymore. So we got to look at what lies in between those two, don't we? That's really important. That's now we're starting to get into the realm of engaged compassion. Yeah.
So it seems like one of them is all about me, mm-hmm. and then one's all about the other. And it's just, you're just swinging on the pendulum from two opposite poles.
Right. Yeah.
You know,
like
so
a kid in a playground. Oh, this is
fun. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. A playground, exactly. Yeah. And then when you feel like one pole didn't work, you'll jump to the other pole.
That's right.
But you'll never find the discrimination between.
And each one will be comfortable for a little while.
Yes, exactly. As an idea or something.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting snippet to feel like when your own self-care and the self-care of others drops away.
Yes.
And in that state, caring for yourself is caring for others, and caring for others is caring for yourself.
Yes, yes. You can use compassion as a powerful vehicle for loosening the grip of delusion on you. You know, you are. Yeah. Well, this is what we call grasping and clinging to the self. And every time you practice a true act of generosity, and every time you practice true compassion, you're loosening the grip of that delusion, and you know you're moving in the direction of awakening and nirvana. And every time that you succumb to the temptation to take the easy route and not stretch yourself a little bit. Who is it that's doing that? Who are you serving? You're serving the notion of me. You're reinforcing the grip of, this self on you. We've got somebody at the back here. Not sure where the microphone is at the moment.
So we talked about judgment clouding our ability to be compassionate. And so what about expectation of the act of compassion? The attachment to the expectation of the act of compassion.
Yes, absolutely, yes. Yeah, that's kind of what I was getting to when I talked about, you know, you have a friend and you help them out and you have expectations and you're attached to those expectations. You're attached to outcomes. And the most important thing in order to be effective in doing good in the world of any kind is to have no attachment to the outcomes. You know, it's learning total radical acceptance of what is. The past has determined it, you know. All these causal factors add up to the moment that we're in. And the most absurd waste of time possible is to resist that. To resist, the definition of insanity is to resist what is. And it will sap your energy, it will cloud your mind, you know. The future is as yet undetermined. It is in this moment that the choices become available to you. And it's in a series of present moments that you develop the mindfulness and the other mental skills that allow you to make the maximum use of this particular moment to have the greatest effectiveness. And that's why we practice. That's why we practice. So this particular moment. Now, you totally accept the way things are. And you have a vision that the future could be better if something has changed. And so you institute that change. You do what you can to institute that change. Then that future moment becomes the new present. And that new present may not fulfill your expectations. It may not turn out the way you expected it to at all. You've got to treat it exactly the way you did before. It's now you have to totally accept it the way it is. And to not accept what is in this new present moment is just as insane as it would have been in the last. So you've got to try to preserve your sanity moment by moment. And anytime you find yourself disappointed or frustrated, it means that you're losing your sanity and you're resisting what is. And if you stop doing that, you're going to become really, really powerful and effective. So, radical acceptance and total non-attachment to the outcome doesn't mean that you don't do your absolute very best to figure out what the best thing to do is, and that you don't do it in the absolute very best way that you're capable of doing it. But then you're going to come into a new present moment. And it either worked, or it didn't, or it half worked, or whatever. But that's the new reality that you're in. And that's the new reality that you're going to move forward from. So, we have to learn this in order to be compassionate.
With no resentment.
With no resentment, that's right.
No prejudgment.
No prejudgment.
Painting the now. You.
That's right.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. We're reborn in every instant. And so. So. Try to learn to live in that space. Yeah. And you never really know the consequences of your actions anyway. It's not even insane. It's just stupid to think that you can judge this new present as to whether the outcome was good or bad. The outcome was what the outcome was. You're only seeing it now. It's going to continue on. It's going to ripple into the future in every possible direction for, well, until the end of time, if there is an end of time. And if there isn't an end of time, it's just going to keep on rippling out there, right? So if at any point you find yourself deciding that you are just so omniscient that you can judge the goodness or the badness, the success or the failure, the rightness or wrongness of the outcome, you're being not only insane for rejecting what is, but you're being stupid.
It reminds me of a thing about time where they say, yesterday was history, tomorrow's a mystery.
Yeah.
Today's a gift, and that's why it's called the present.
Yes.
And I remembered one time seeing a quote that said, today is the tomorrow that you worried about yesterday.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yeah. And not only that, today is the first day of the rest of your life.
Right.
Right. This very minute is the first moment of the rest of your life. And not only that, the universe has just become born in this moment, and it is going to evolve from it. You're part of the Big Bang, the new Big Bang. So, anyway, let's take a break.